When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to Murder Mile, a true crime podcast, an audio-guided walk, featuring many of London's untold, unsolved, and long-forgotten murders, all set within London's West End. Today's episode is about the cruel and senseless death of Charlie Chirgwin, an innocent who wasn't stabbed, beaten, or shot, but whose last hours alive were decided by rules, red tape, and petty revenge. And yet Charlie would never know that, as he was only 14 weeks old. Murder Mile is researched using the original police files. It contains moments of satire, shock, and grisly details. And as a dramatization of the real events, it may also feature loud and realistic sounds. So that no matter where you listen to this podcast, you'll feel like you're actually there. My name is Michael, I am your tour guide, and this is Murder Mile. Episode 61, The Senseless Killing of Charlie Chirgwin. Today, I'm standing in Shorts Gardens, WC2. Two streets east of the wife-beating baker, Alexander Moyer. One street southwest of the mysterious murder of the lonely spinster, Daisy Wallace. And one street north of the unsolved murder of Russian Dora. Coming soon to Murder Mile. Situated between Shaftesbury Avenue and Longacre, Shorts Gardens is an odd one-way street at the back of Covent Garden, used mostly as a cut-through by cabbies, brickies, and Uber Eats. That pointless service for lazy, feckless half-wits who are one step away from needing an app to wipe their own arse. Surrounded by a queasy excess of funky barbers, crazy cafes, flip-flop boutiques, and possibly a falafel museum, this side of Shorts Gardens staunchly refuses to evolve. It's a tree-lined street, lost in a 1970s time warp, with window boxes full of pampas grass, pavements full of white dog poo, and a laundrette full of old dears dreaming about the good old days of spam, rationing, and syphilis. So if you think that prawn cocktail, vol-au-vents, and cheese cubes on sticks is the height of chic, then this place is for you. On the eastern corner of Shorts Gardens and Endell Street is Dudley Court, a six-story brown-bricked block of flats with a convenience store on the ground floor, a mix of council and private flats above, and balconies full of bike bits, carpet cut-offs, and part-dried underpants. And like most awful architecture, it was clearly designed by a clumsy child who had a seizure whilst playing with Lego. Now entirely demolished, on this site once stood the St. Giles Workhouse. A brutal, unforgiving place where the borough's sickest, poorest, and most destitute were sent to work, to live, and often to die. As it was here, on Thursday the 14th of November, 1872, that the life and death of 14-week-old Charlie Chirgwin was decided by a petty superintendent. Being just a baby, very little is known about Charlie. His mother's name was Eliza, but it could have been Elizabeth. She was possibly from Penzance and was born sometime in or around 1847, making her 24 years old. But being one of London's forgotten paupers, her life was deemed too unworthy to record. So eking out a hand-to-mouth existence and never knowing how she would feed her family from one day to the next, the only evidence we have of her pitiful little life is through the death of her baby boy. For Eliza, life was tough. As an only child, with both parents dead, her only family was a disabled aunt and a young cousin living in a cramped one-roomed lodging in Crown Street, Soho. Although illiterate, having worked since the age of five and trained as a waistcoat hand, with no income and no home of her own, her days were spent struggling to raise 4 pennies to pay for a night's lodging and begging to be admitted to the workhouse. So endemic was poverty in the 1800s that each borough within walking distance of Soho had its own workhouse, including the Strand Union and St Giles. Funded by the local council and managed by the church, although they were built to feed, clothe and shelter those less fortunate, the workhouse was more like a pauper's prison, where the impoverished were punished simply for being poor. As a last refuge for almost 800 people, each workhouse housed an unholy mix of the city's desperate, including the disabled, the diseased and the dying, the pregnant, the pitiful and the putrid, the imbeciles, the vagrants and the inmates, whether young or old, male or female, senile or insane. The only difference being which ward you entered and how, if at all, you left. As the casual ward took in anyone too poor to pay for a night's lodgings, the workhouse was deemed a debtor's prison for those sentenced here by the court, and the infirmary was for the ill, the infectious and the incurable. In long dark halls, lines of pale expressionless faces sat in strict silence, forced to endure menial tasks like picking oakum. A thick twine hardened with black tar, so tough it made their fingers bleed, so hard it made their thumbs swell, for 16 hours a day, and all to pay their keep. In return, their meals were a watery slop, their beds were old and lumpy, and their care was inhumane. But for many, this miserable little life was better than living on the streets. Age 19, Eliza gave birth to her first child, Mary, in the lice-infested filth of the St Giles workhouse. Age 22, her second child, William, was born in the pitiful squalor of the St Pancras workhouse. Age 23, Eliza married the child's father, William Gerard. And with the two having decided to start a new life in America, for once, Eliza had high hopes and big dreams. But with her passage denied, as her new husband boarded the ship bound for Chicago and waved her goodbye, Eliza was left behind, clutching their few possessions, a 7-year-old girl, a 4-year-old boy, and a large swelling in her belly. A few months later, living in abject poverty, her third baby was born in the cold and rancid filth of the St. Giles workhouse. A little baby boy, who she would call Charlie. Charlie was a happy baby, a cheeky little bundle of joy, who cuddled but cried very little. Although he was born a little undersized, being blessed with a loving mother, who, only being slight herself, would sooner starve than see her children go without. Charlie was well fed. His tiny little limbs and chubby little belly wrapped in a thick layer of baby fat to protect him from the harsh winter ahead. As being raised in a workhouse, the life expectancy for a child under 5 was less than 1 in 20. With no home, no money, and no father, just 3 months into his short life, Charlie would be dead. But he wasn't starved, poisoned, or even beaten. No, the death of this quiet little boy would be even more senseless, even more tragic. And it was all because of a man called George Cannon. But he wasn't a maniac, a killer, or a sadistic paedophile. 33-year-old George Cannon had no criminal record, and although he claimed to be a good Christian, he had an unchristian attitude. Being short and portly, George was a haughty little Jobsworth, who, as assistant superintendent of the St. Giles Workhouse, had just one job to do: to receive all voluntary submissions to the casuals ward, providing beds, warmth and food for mothers and babies. The rules were simple. If a space was free and the person wasn't rude or drunk, the bed was theirs. Except, feeling righteous, with an ounce of responsibility, George felt it was his divine right to decide who slept there, who ate there, and who stayed warm and dry, as his one job made him feel like a god over the poor. On the 17th of October 1872, Eliza arrived at the casuals ward of St. Giles. One bed was free, but being tired, hungry, and unsteady on her feet, George called the police, claiming she was drunk. With the police unwilling to charge her, with no other option, he gave her a bed. But on his terms. By the morning, Eliza would have to pick a full half pound of oakum. Instead of sleeping, being gripped with worry, and with two young children at her side and a two-month-old at her breast, although her thumbs were badly blistered, she spent the night pulling apart coarse tarred rope, until, weak with exhaustion, she nodded off. With the oakum unfinished, George put a black mark against her name, and Eliza and her children were booted out of St. Giles. It may seem like a rather petty and even childish act, but this is where the senseless death of Eliza's little boy began. And 1 month later, he would be dead. The 8 years prior had been the wettest on record, with the winter seeing a year's rainfall in just 4 months. The harvest was soggy, the economy was rough, and disease was rampant. With the weather bad, business was bad. And with her fingers bruised and blistered, as the nights barely rose above freezing, although broke, Eliza's hands shook so much she couldn't sew a button onto a single waistcoat. That week, little Charlie had a cold. It wasn't anything serious, just a sniffle and a cough which was on its way out, as his loving mother had swaddled him in long clothes and snuggled him next to her warm heaving chest as he suckled on her nourishing milk. On the night of Wednesday the 13th of November, with her cousin away, Eliza slept in the modest comfort of her aunt's one-roomed lodging on Crown Street in Soho. It wasn't much, but it was warm and dry. The next night, with her cousin back, and unable to scrape together 4 pennies for the night's lodgings, Eliza and her children headed out to the nearest workhouse, known as the Strand Union. Crown Street to Cleveland Street is 0.5 mile. It should have taken no longer than 12 minutes. But with a fierce storm brewing, as Eliza battled to shield her babies from the stinging rain and bitter icy wind, protected from the cold, but not the wet. Their thick woolen clothes soon became sodden. Having left just after 6:15, Eliza arrived at 36 Cleveland Street at 6:45. With log fires blazing, tea brewing, and a stew on the stove, the warmth of the Strand Union workhouse was welcoming, as the heat tingled their frozen limbs. Greeting them at the doorway, Mr. Keller, the relieving officer of the Strand Union, stated that, as they stood there, dripping and shivering, with pools of water forming around their feet, it was as if someone had dragged them out of the Thames. And although the family was desperate, the news was not good. The wards were closed. With the casual ward shut and the workhouse locked down, even though the infirmary stayed open for the chronically ill, with none of them being sick, no beds were free. Thankfully, rules had been set which stipulated that any casuals the Strand Union could not accept would be received by the St. Giles workhouse. And seeing Eliza and her babies as a priority, Mr. Keller handed Eliza an order to confirm this. It read, "To the master of the St. Giles workhouse, admit Eliza Chirgwin and her three children, Mary, William and Charles. Signed, G. Keller, Assistant Relieving Officer." With a signed order in her hand, a surplus of beds at St. Giles, and being stone-cold sober, Eliza would have no problem finding shelter that night. Especially as George Cannon was very aware of the rules. Having received his orders 4 weeks prior, he sent a letter to the Board of Guardians. It read,
"I beg to inform you that I commenced, last evening, receiving casual paupers from the Strand Workhouse. Trusting that you will kindly take into consideration the extra amount of duty which I now perform, and that his salary increase would be forthcoming. I remain your obedient servant, George Cannon."
Cleveland Street to Short's Gardens is just shy of 1 mile. It should have taken no longer than 25 minutes. But battling a brutal headwind, icy blasts of Arctic snow, and their soaked woolen clothes beginning to freeze on their shivering skin. Although they were forced to stop twice, hearing a familiar wheeze from Charlie's chest, Eliza ploughed on, desperate to get them all warm, dry, fed, and a bed. With their legs like lead, their faces flushed red raw, and the children's tears dangling like icicles, even though they had barely 1 hour to reach the workhouse before the heavy wooden gates were shut. Through strength and determination, Eliza arrived at the casuals ward of St. Giles at 7:30. The doorbell clanged. The family waited. The gate unlocked. Stood before them, all short and portly, his beady little eyes like a blanket of fresh snow soiled by dog shit. His lips pursed like an old toothless hag sucking a lemon, and the hairs of his flared nostrils hanging like rows of unused nooses. Illuminated by a single flickering candle was George Cannon. Although a good few inches shorter than Eliza, peering along the length of his upturned nose, through spectacles which precariously perched on his nose's tip, he still managed to look down on her, as around his neck a crucifix hung, as if Jesus himself would absolve him of his sins. Glaring at the bedraggled shadows, George nasally snorted,
"You want a night's lodging?"
As stood in the bitter icy rain, Eliza meekly stammered,
"Yes."
Her lips too cold to form anything more as she handed him the order with a shivering hand. Snatching it, George slowly read all 22 words. a look of disdain at the letter, which superseded his own mighty authority. All the while, his corpulent wife stood behind him, shoveling fistfuls of food into her fat, sweaty face. Holding the order by his fewest fingers, George huffed,
"Well, come in then."
And as the ward's door opened, the warmth of the log fire, the smell of a hot meal, and a sense of relief swept over them. As for that night at least, Eliza and her family were safe. Or they should have been. To George Cannon, the name Eliza Chirgwin wasn't synonymous with the struggling mum in dire need of his help. She was an obstinate insult on decent society, who had flatly refused his demand to pick a half pound of oakum. And with a black mark against her name, this haughty little Jobsworth had one simple rule to abide by. If a space was free, and the person wasn't rude or drunk, the bed was theirs. As Eliza entered the gate, with her icy hands shaking, and her rigid lips too cold to properly say,
"Thank you."
Being too weak to stand, Eliza stumbled a little. A single misstep over the base of the gate. George barked,
"Oh, you're drunk again, are you?"
Eliza pleaded,
"No, I'm not."
But her pleas fell on deaf ears, as George decreed,
"Stand here, you drunken beast,"
and sent for the police. And as Eliza stood there, too meek to argue back, too weak to stand her ground, as her broken little family stood there crying, shivering in sodden frozen clothes, Charlie's little lungs began to rasp. At 8 p.m, PC Samuel Kemp was summoned to the St. Giles workhouse to arrest an abusive drunk. With no drunk in sight, and the only obscenities spat by the seething superintendent and his abusive spouse, as Eliza cradled her weeping babies, a baffled PC Kemp asked, "Mr. Cannon, you're surely not going to charge this woman with being drunk?" George rebuked,
"I shall do so."
Drenched himself, PC Kemp asked, "But you're surely not going to send those children out on a night like this?" To which George barked,
"I surely shall. And you will take them to the station."
But PC Kemp flatly refused. Bristling with rage at the constable's impertinence, George spat,
"Fine. For failing to take charge, I shall report you."
PC Kemp was a married man, with two children of his own. And unwilling to risk his career over something so trivial, he begrudgingly trudged the frozen family another quarter mile to Bow Street Police Station. George Cannon in tow, rubbing his hands with glee at his petty victory. With Bow Street being a police court, as was the rules, Eliza stood in the dock, accused of the charge of being drunk and abusive, two screaming kids at her feet, a suckling baby at her breast. Seeing the charges unfounded, with PC Kemp on her side, and Inspector William Usher stating of Eliza,
"I never saw a more humble or harmless woman."
As George vociferously argued about why this woman must be charged, the police took pity on the family, their fate at the mercy of this petty little man. And as the nasty little legs of George Cannon sped back to St. Giles, throwing aside his papers and files to seek out a minor clause in an Act of Parliament which decreed by law that they must charge her for the little-known crime of acquiring lodgings using a false name. The name in question being Gerard, her married name. As Inspector Usher fought Eliza's case, his sergeant fed the family with hot tea and toast as they sat by the fire, Mary and William asleep, Charlie's chest now rattling. At 9 p.m, Inspector Usher had the family examined by Dr. Mills, the police surgeon. Although cold and malnourished, Eliza, Mary and William were well. But Charlie was not. Being swathed in soaking wet wool and exposed to bitter winter winds for the last 3 hours, with his pale skin trembling, his tiny limbs icy cold, and the whistling of his little chest being a dire indication of bronchitis, Dr. Mills wrote an order admitting Eliza and her children to the nearest workhouse, outranking George Cannon. Accompanied by Constable Scott, and clutching a doctor's order, Eliza and her babies were forced to slog another quarter mile through a torrent of freezing rain from the Bow Street police station until they returned back to the casuals ward of the St. Giles workhouse. Once again, the doorbell clanged. Once again, the family waited. Once again, the gate unlocked. As stood before them, all short and portly, his arms folded like a locked gate, his nostrils flared like a furious bull, and his little beady eyes like full stops. George Cannon barked,
"She's not coming in here. She's drunk."
As at his side, having lied to him, was the assistant surgeon of the workhouse. Being only a constable, incredulously, PC Scott asked,
"Won't you take her in?"
But the answer was clear, as George sneered,
"No."
With the nearest workhouse being the Strand Union, whose wards were shut, George snorted,
"Take her away then."
As once again, he turfed the wet, cold and shivering family out into the darkness. And with another 1 mile slog ahead, before he slammed the gate shut on them forever, George retorted,
"Make her walk. She's more than able to."
With Charlie weak and pale, as a matter of urgency, PC Scott held a horse-drawn carriage. And with the family huddled under a dry blanket, their shivering faces shielded by a canopy, they rode back to the Strand Union at 36 Cleveland Street, where their journey had begun. Seeing Charlie's pitiful state, Mr. Keller, the relieving officer of the Strand Union, took them straight to the infirmary. Eliza, Mary and William were given dry clothes, hot tea and warm beds. And as a rasping baby was attended to by nurses, broken with exhaustion, Eliza wept,
"Bless you. God bless you all."
Given just the basics that any human requires, food, warmth, and medicine, the little boy soldiered on for 3 more days. But with his lungs too weak and unable to feed, on Sunday the 17th of November, 1872, 14-week-old Charlie Chirgwin died. Examined by John Argus, medical officer of the Strand Union, he stated, although an undersized baby, his body was plump, his organs were healthy, and with his slight cold almost cleared, being exposed to a bitter winter wind, in wet clothes for 4 hours, Charlie had succumbed to bronchial pneumonia. George Cannon was tried on the 16th of December 1872 at the Old Bailey, under the charge of manslaughter, which he denied and pleaded not guilty. With emotions running high, Mr. Justice Quayne asked the jury,
"Not to allow feelings of humanity to run away with your judgment and make the prisoner a victim of the system. as the real offenders are those who had authorized to send paupers from one union to another, no matter what the weather.
After a short deliberation, being certain that it was his selfish and petty actions which had exacerbated the baby's death, George Cannon was found guilty of manslaughter. And although the judge was eager that this act should be a warning to others, he sentenced him to prison for just 12 months. Eliza's baby had lived for less than 3. Charlie Chirgwin was a healthy little boy, and although raised in abject poverty, being blessed with a loving parent, against the odds, he may have survived. But the death of Charlie Chirgwin was cruel and senseless. He was an innocent whose last hours alive were decided by rules, red tape, and the petty revenge on a mother who only wanted a bed for her babies. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for listening to Murder Mile. Don't forget Murky Milers. Stay tuned for extra goodies after the break. But before that, here's my recommended podcasts of the week, which are Mums and Murder and Murderific.
Hey guys, it's Melissa
and Mandy
with the Moms and Murder podcast. We're a true crime podcast that's sure to make you laugh without compromising the seriousness of the content.
Despite our name, we aren't just for the moms. Our show is for all the Diet Coke drinking, chicken loving, Dateline watching people in your life. Come for the murder and stay for the witty humor and pop culture references.
And you never know, you may even hear from some of your favorite names in the world of true crime, like Dateline's Josh Mankiewicz.
Do you have a preference on what we call you, Josh Mankiewicz, Manx, Sir Manx-a-Lot?
I don't hear Sir Manx-a-Lot quite as often as I...
I can make it happen for you.
Broken Homicide's Derek Lavasser.
Are you tearing up on me? I saw you waiting.
So beautiful, everything you're saying.
Or even America's sweetheart, Ally Sweeney.
The neighbor suggested that perhaps Kathleen had been attacked by... an owl.
The owl theory that Melissa and Ally Sweeney believe.
Again, so judgy.
Check out Moms and Murder anywhere podcasts are found.
Check out the Murderific True Crime Podcast, hosted by Bernadette from the state of Maine. Topics will include some seriously true scary stories about serial killers, mass murderers, familicides, the missing, and unsolved cases. Go to www.murderific.com to start listening now, or anywhere you listen to podcasts. Until then, we will be executing podcasts one crime at a time.
A huge thank you goes out to my new Patreon supporters, who are Graham Sillers, Stella Singer, Tina Courtland, Barbara Johnson, and Suzanne Fox. With a thank you to old patrons and returning patrons who are enjoying the new goodies, such as location videos, crime scene photos exclusive to Patreon, a weekly ebook of the unedited Murder Mile scripts, and a handwritten thank you card from me with Murder Mile badges, stickers, and an official Murky Miler badge. Ooh! A big thank you also this week to Molly, Aaron, and the gang from the University of Idaho, who booked a private Murder Mile walk. It was lovely to meet you all, and thank you for being amazing. Next week's episode is a two-parter, and you will receive both parts that day, so don't delete one of them thinking it's a mistake. It's a very different episode to what you're used to, so get ready. Murder Mile was researched, written, and performed by myself, with the main musical themes written and performed by Eric Stein and John Books of Cult with No Name. Thank you for listening, and sleep well.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices
down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Ooh. Ba-ba-da-da-ba-ba-ba. Hello, everyone. Welcome to Extra Mile. I forgot what it's called then. I'm going to go off and put on my tea. Hang on, I've got to open the windows and the doors. Oh, dear. Windows open. Door open. Here we go. Whoa. I'm up nice and early today. And I'm right next to a busy road. I wanted to make sure that I was recording before everyone started coming out. Luckily there was only police cars because I'm in Hackney, and Hackney, obviously, you know, lots of police needed in Hackney because there's lots of excitement, lots of excitable people. So there's lots of police cars going past, and there's a man going past who obviously has a very loud motorbike, and he likes the fact that his motorbike is loud. So, but that wasn't too bad. It wasn't a difficult record. So how are you all? Are you all good? Just putting on my tea. Hang on. Tea. I have an Earl Grey tea. There we go. Coming back. Right. Tea on, door open. Yes. Oh, this is Extra Mile. For new people, this is Extra Mile. This is the bit afterwards where I explain a lot of things that are in the show that you might not know about the episode. And it's unedited. I'll go off and make a cup of tea if I have to. I'll open the doors if I have to. Sometimes people knock on my boat and have a conversation with me, and I have to go and speak to them. That happened on the last one, but I edited that out because I redid the audio, because the audio was awful. But this, I think, will be okay. I think. Microphone was on. Good. I just checked then. Right. So, where am I? Right. On the boat. Recording today. I'm up early because I've got to get to the dentist at 2 o'clock. Unfortunately, I've broken one of my teeth, one of the ones at the back. It's really annoying. I woke up one morning and was like, what am I eating? What did I eat last night? It feels like I've been eating eggs, but I ate the shell as well. And then I checked and I realised I'd broken a tooth. Which is really annoying. My dentist did say last time, he said, ooh, that tooth at the back is a bit like eggshells. And yeah, so I've got to go in at 2 o'clock and get that fixed. And at the same time, recovering from a police going past. I'm in Hackney. That happens like every 5 minutes. Really does. About 10 days ago, I was moving the boat and I was putting it through a lock. So a lock is, in case you don't know, you can look at them online, canal locks. It's basically, there's a difference between a height. Oh, can't even explain it today. I'm so tired. It literally is. It's waking, putting your boat, and it goes down. Have a look on the internet. I don't need to explain it. Anyway, I was getting off the lock. I was moving the boat. I slipped. My left foot was 45 degrees, the wrong angle that it should have been, and I kind of landed on it awkwardly. And I thought, oh, that hurts a bit. And then I walked on and thought, oh, do you know, it's not broken at all. I can still walk on it. It's not fractured. So I thought, that's fine. So I moved the boat through the lock, and then I moved it through two or three more locks. And then as I got to the fourth lock, I was like, oh, look at that. That's swollen. My ankle. It was almost as if someone had put a big donut around my ankle. It was huge. So I pulled it through two more locks because I was in the middle of a step lock. You know, you can't moor up anywhere between it. I had to get it through. I got it through, moored up the boat. And then the next day, I looked at my ankle and I went, oh dear, it was huge. And I'm going to just get my tea. The next day, all of the swelling around the ankle had shifted. It had shifted to all down the foot. So the foot had gone really, really squishy, which is really horrible. When you kind of move on it, you could hear all the liquid inside squishing around. So I knew it was sprained because it was squishing. Courtesy of Sherlock. Episode in Sherlock where they explain about sprain, difference between sprains and breaks and fractures. That was very useful. and then my foot was starting to go really swollen and black, and bruised in places. So I've spent about 10 days with my feet up. So I cancelled one of my murder miles. Just basically spent a week with my feet in an ice bag. Oh, luckily I'm very near to a big supermarket, so I can just get out and grab a big of ice. But it's almost fixed now. I actually have shaped my feet now. Before it was like a block of fat. It was all just swollen. Oh, it's horrible. Now it's just a bit black in places. So, but there we go, almost fixed. So, and at the same time, I decided to wean myself off Diet Coke. I don't really have a Diet Coke problem, but I always have one a day. It was like either a can or one of those little bottles, not the big ones. I'm not an idiot. One of those little ones. But I decided to wean myself off it because I was thinking, oh, I don't want to... You know, sometimes you can get the headaches off it. So I did. I weaned myself off it. I was like, right, no Diet Coke today. And then at lunchtime, the headaches started. And it was 3 days of headaches. If you drink a Diet Coke every day, you just have one. And you think, I'm not addicted to Diet Coke. Give it a go. Try and quit Diet Coke for 5 days. And I guarantee you, you'll be like, oh my God, I am an addict. Because your brain, because of the aspartame, your brain will just go, I need my Diet Coke fix. It's hard. But the first 3 days are really difficult. But after that, you get through it, the addiction stops. And then it's okay after that. So now it's great. Now I can go into shops and not have to pick up a Diet Coke. And I haven't replaced it with anything else, which is good. Diet Coke's bad for you anyway. It's just chemicals, isn't it? Anyway, so that was my week. That was all good. Oh, and I had another good week as well. We went to a lovely play at the Coach and Horses. Coach and Horses is a really nice pub in Soho. Or it was, but Fuller's arseholes. They've taken over the pub. It used to be an independent old pub. It's been there for like 300 years. It's really famous. Loads of plays were written there. Do you know, it's really famous. The Fullers are taking it over. And they're going to turn it into a gastro pub or some shit like that. But Coach Norris is a really good, decent boozer. It's a pub just down from where I finished my walk. And we went there the other day to watch Jeffrey Bernard is Unwell. It's a very famous play. It was originally performed by Peter O'Toole. John Hurt did it. John Hurt did it. And we went to see it performed by Robert Bathurst. But it's good because that play is written in that pub. It's performed in that pub. So it was nice to see it in where it's meant to be. So the character wakes up in the pub. And basically all the staff have gone and he's trapped there all night. But they performed it in the pub. It was really good. So we went to see that performed by Robert Bathurst. By the time you listen to this, I think it will have finished, which is a shame. You could have gone to see it, but you didn't. But it was very good, very good. So, that's some early waffle out of the way. I've got my tea on the go. Oh, slurp, very nice. No cake, I ran out of cake. I'm going to go and get some shortly. Had some nice lemon cake from Asda. Normally Asda don't do very good cakes, but their lemon loaf is very good. Very good, very soft. Anyway, right. This case, where did it come from? This was There we go. It's people going past in a boat, and they're not looking where they're going. They're taking selfies. Happens a lot around here. Oh, dear Lord. Anyway, this case, the case of Eliza Chirgwin, or Charlie Chirgwin, as the case is really about, the baby. This was one of those cases that I knew about ages ago. Originally, this was going to be a story that I was going to do on the tour when I was building up stories of what I could do on the walk. But when I did the research, it was interesting, but when I did the research, it was slightly out of the area that I do the walk on, because I don't really do it on a quarter mile. I do it on like a, I think it's like a third of a mile square I do on the walk. So it was a little bit too far to walk out to, and also I didn't feel that it was right for the tour, because it's not really a kind of a murder. You want to kind of get your serial killers in and your spree killers and stuff like that on the walk. And when I was doing the podcast, I kept thinking to myself, it's not right for the podcast either, because it's another one of those ones that's not really a murder, is it? There's no real true crime in it. But it was one of those ones I had on my list for ages, just like Glyndor Michael. So the homeless guy who, you know, died by eating a poisoned piece of bread. And then he was the guy who went on and, you know, was the reason why D-Day was successful. And, you know, he's the reason why we're all still alive today. And then the other story was the Alexander Moyer one, the brutal baker who beat his wife to death. Those were all stories that I didn't feel would fit right in Murder Mile in the podcast. But when I did them, there was like a really good reaction from everyone. Everyone kind of liked it. I think because they're really nice human stories. And, you know, it doesn't, true crime stories don't need to be man with an axe cutting off heads and all shit like that. You know, it doesn't need to be sensational. I think the smaller they are, the more human they are, the more interesting they become. Because it's, you're less focused on how did someone murder this other person. You're more interested in them as a human being. And that's, and that's what I try to do with Murder Mile. I make very human stories as opposed to tabloid sensational rubbish. So that's why I did this one. This has been on the cards for a little while, and then I decided, you know what, let's do it. Let's put this one in. And I quite like it. It's quite a tragic story. And again, not murder. It's a manslaughter. Technically, even though the judge technically was trying to, I'll explain it later on, but actually the judge was sitting down with the jury and saying to them, do you know, you need to decide who's on trial here. Is it George Cannon who's on trial, or is it the system that's on trial? Is it the Board of Governors who made the decision to be on trial? And he is right that it was a crazy system that they did say, do you know, if this workhouse is open, then we'll send people to the other workhouse. But even like this, as I said at the start, this was 8 years of torrential rain in London. This is one of the worst weathers they had. It was the start of winter. The other workhouses, weirdly, they never explained why the casuals ward and the workhouse was shut, even in the court documents. And they even mention it in there as well, saying there was no explanation why it was shut, which is weird. But anyway, so yeah, the system was on trial as well. I thought this was a difficult case to research, because we only really have the court documents to do with the murder of Charlie to go with it. For Eliza and her family, really difficult to get any information on her. Obviously, according to the court documents, her name was Eliza Chirgwin. So that was her birth name. She may have been called Elizabeth, because Eliza was a shortened version of Elizabeth, although that could have been her middle name as well. It could have been the name she went by. We don't have her accurate name. Chirgwin is quite an interesting name. Unfortunately, Eliza and probably, as you noticed, George are two of the most popular names in the mid-18th century, or mid-1800s. So that made it difficult to find her. There is a family called Chirgwin. Most of them originate from around Penzance, around the mid-1850s, so we kind of assuming that that's where she comes from, but we don't actually know that. We don't know her accurate date of birth. We know that she was 24. She could have been 23, or she could have been 25, which makes it really difficult. No details about her parents, so it is believed that they died, but none of that. We don't know fully. There's no marriage certificate between her and her husband. We're unsure of the correct spelling of her husband, because it's only It was transcribed in the court documents, which makes it difficult. So again, his first name might not have been William. It could have been his middle name. A lot of people use their middle name instead of their first name. And his surname was Gerard. It could be Gerard or Gerard. And there's multiple spellings of Gerard. And we don't know how old he is. I checked the shipping manifests for between... obviously, around the time after she supposedly got married to him and the death of baby Charlie, that supposedly is around the time that he left for Chicago. And I checked the shipping manifest and I can't find anyone called Gerard going to America. And he definitely went to America. She said he went to Chicago, although that could be wrong. So that makes his life really difficult. What happened to her? We also don't know that as well. She may have died in the workhouse. It's highly likely. Don't forget, she was a woman. It was the mid-1800s. Chance of her dying in childbirth was pretty high. I mean, the chance of her children surviving, it's amazing that she got two that actually survived up until that point of the story. She may have had more children. We don't know. But these are the only ones that we know about. We don't know their fate either. I did a search. Couldn't find anything on them, so it's. But as I said at the start, you know, they're poor people. Very little is written about their lives unless something really tragic happens. That's the only time that we really find details about them. Whew. So, details about the buildings. There's two buildings in here. Oddly, one of them I keep going past all the time, and I keep looking at it, thinking, "Oh, I hope there's something interesting there." Okay, so the first one was the Strand Union Workhouse. Part of it still exists. It's on 36 Cleveland Street. It's not being used anymore. For years, it kind of went through phases of being... I'll put some pictures online. If you go on to any of my social media accounts, you'll see... I'm saying this now, but I haven't done it yet. But by the time you listen to this, hopefully I will have done it. There'll be some videos online so you can see what they look like now, and I can do some comparison shots so you can see what it originally looked like. The Strand Union, where... originally she was rejected because it was closed, and then when she came back, Charles was taken into the infirmary, and that's where he died, at Cleveland Street. That's still there today. It's been listed very recently. It looks horrible at the moment. It's protected by guardians at the moment. They're keeping an eye on it because it's an old crumbling old building, but they're trying to convert it into something else. It's in Fitzrovia, so just north of Soho. And it's just in the shadow of the BT Tower. But it was used for years. It's like a four-storied building with two wings on it. It looks very old. It looks very kind of brutalist. But it went through years. This used to be what they called the Middlesex Hospital. So I think I've mentioned that a couple of times. There were a couple of characters in there who were taken there. On the Charlotte Street robbery, so Alex D'Antiquis... who was shot by the robbers, that's where he was taken. So that's I mentioned that. So that is literally about three streets away from Charlotte Street. So we're not too far away, but people walk past it all the time and they look at it and they don't know that it's the old Strand Workhouse, but it is. It's gone through many guises. It used to be a hospital up until about 20 years ago, but they shut it down. There's two wings on it and you can walk in. There's a main kind of courtyard. There's entrance gates on either side, so there'll be the casuals ward on the left and then the workhouse ward on the right. It accepted male and female. There was no delineation between male and female. It was basically the poor were poor, and basically you went in. Casuals, as I mentioned, was you could literally walk in there and say, I can't afford to pay my lodgings for the night, and if they had a space, they'd make a space for you. The workhouse was you were sent there by the courts. So if you couldn't afford to look after your kids, or you couldn't afford to, you know, if basically you were deemed unfit, then you were sent to the workhouse for a period of time. Cool, that was good timing. There's a rubbish truck just pulled up just in front of me. So now there's going to be a lot of noise. Great. I had a look for the auntie's house. So I was trying to find more about Eliza and her family, and I thought, well, she's got an auntie and a cousin there, so I'll search. Unfortunately, we don't know the auntie's name. She's only ever referenced as auntie, and the other one's referenced as cousin, which is always useful. They lived on Crown Street. Crown Street doesn't exist anymore. None of the buildings exist because Crown Street is on the border of Soho and what would be St Giles, the borough of St Giles. Just to say that St Giles, the workhouse, is named after the borough it's in, so it's the St Giles workhouse. But between both of those boroughs, Soho, Soho is technically St Anne's, and St Giles is what we now call Charing Cross Road. Charing Cross Road, originally, if you look at it, it's quite wide, but originally it wasn't. It was two streets. It was Crown Street and Hogs Lane. And what they did was they demolished both of those streets to make Charing Cross Road. But if you're ever in Soho, if you go to the Harry Potter, what's it called, the play that's on at the moment that everyone queues up and gets excited about outside, just up from there, in the middle of the road, there's kind of some grates in the middle of the road. And if you look down into the grate, you can still see Hogs Lane. It's still there. And that's because if you look at Charing Cross Road, it's on an angle. It goes down from Leicester Square at the bottom to the start of Oxford Street. Start of Oxford Street, Tottenham Court Road at the top. But it goes in an incline. But originally, it was like a really horrible step at the top, and they didn't want that. So what they did was they made a kind of an incline instead of a step on the road. So what they did was they built on top of Hogs Lane and Crown Street. So if you look through the grating, you can still see the streets there. They just built on top of it. It's really interesting. There's like still a street sign there, and it's like an old street that's still hidden away. So it's quite interesting. Might not be interesting to you. You might look at it and go, "That's shit." Some pieces that were in there, some pieces obviously I didn't use in the story, but in the court documents they obviously spoke to James Rankley, and James Rankley was the master of the St Giles workhouse. So he was George Cannon's boss, and he said, "It is the practice of the casual ward to take off the wet clothes of the paupers and to furnish them with dry clothes until their own have been dried. If a constable in uniform brings a person to the workhouse, such a person must be admitted. The presence of a constable is equivalent to an order. The certificate the constable brought to the workhouse, signed by the divisional surgeon, was unnecessary to procure admission, but obviously it was a double up. So they got the constable and they got the divisional surgeon. So by rights, Eliza should have been admitted no matter what. So she should have been admitted first, because they had the order from the Strand workhouse, but obviously George Cannon said no, she was drunk, which she wasn't. And then they got the police surgeon's order, but he decided to supersede it. James Rankley, who was the master of the St Giles workhouse, said he was not made aware of any of this until 3 hours later, so that was about midnight. Death of Charles. They said that about 5 o'clock he became very restless, he coughed. He had a wheezing in his chest. On the Friday, so the next day in the morning, the doctor turned up and subscribed medicine for it. We got the doctor's report coming up shortly. That was actually the same guy who did the autopsy on the baby as well. He was given medicine and poultices were applied. On Saturday, the baby came worse, and by Sunday at 4:30, doesn't say AM or PM, it died. Let's just whiz through that bit. So John Angus, member of the Royal College of Surgeons, licensed of the Apothecaries Company, a medical officer of the Strand Union. On Friday morning, the 15th of November, between 10 and 11 o'clock, that's the next day, I saw the deceased child. It was suffering from the effects of cold. I ordered linseed poultices to be applied both to the back and front of the child. I prescribed, so that's obviously like a decongestant and the mental thing to try and clear his system. Obviously, this is mid 1850s, so medicine really isn't hugely advanced. They're just doing everything they can, but this child is pneumonia. His chance of survival is slim at best, if at all. And I prescribed medicine for it. On Saturday, it had become much worse. I last saw him alive on Saturday. After its death, I love how they always say it, by direction of the coroner, I made a post-mortem examination. I can't speak anymore. When I found that the child had suffered from bronchial pneumonia, which I believe was the cause of death. I believe from the state of the child when I first saw it that the inflammation had not existed for more than a day. So it was actually exacerbated. It hadn't had pneumonia prior to the Thursday, but it had. The baby had had a cold. See, I'm saying it as well. Informing my opinion, I took the account all circumstances of the case. I found the organs, excepting the lungs, in healthy condition. I've been a surgeon for 30 years. The longer the exposure of the child, such as the greater the danger. That's almost English. If at the time it had a slight cold, exposure would still be more dangerous. To keep a child in wet clothing from 7 to 8:30 or 9:45 would have a tendency to shorten its life. If it had been suffering from a cold, keeping it in wet clothes and exposed to damp air were calculated to produce the disease which I found making the post-mortem examination. When cross-examined in court, he said if a child was suffering from a cough and was carried through the pouring rain for 3/4 of an hour, that would tend to produce a disorder as that of which this child died. So that's kind of the reason why at the start that the judge was saying, you know, because it took roughly 3/4 of an hour to get from, well, it took about 30 minutes to get from the aunt's house over to the Strand Union. And then it took another 45 minutes to get from the Strand Union to St Giles. So that is technically just over an hour. So with the doctor there saying, you know, 45 minutes could be enough to kind of exacerbate the child's condition. That's why they were kind of saying, is it really the system that's at fault or is it George that's at fault? Obviously, with this story, I focused on George because I felt that his actions were really quite petty and bitter. But, you know, it is the fault of the system as well. The system should have said, you know, if a woman with a baby turns up and it's absolutely pissing down and the child's just had a cold, is it really sensible to send a family out in the freezing cold and rain so they can get, you know, drenched and then go and get dry? Or is it kind of better just to say, do you know what, we're not open tonight, but come in, sit by the fire for an hour, hopefully the rain will piss off in a bit, if not we'll give you a bed, you know? But there we go. So that was that case. Hope you enjoyed that was interesting. Got listeners questions here. Do you know what, I haven't even read them, so I really should have done it. Listeners questions from Matt Casey, so thanks for Matt. Two questions. So the first one was, what is your whole take on the news that the Jack the Ripper suspect was identified by DNA? So if you look at this, people keep reposting this on all the true crime sites and everyone thinks it's topical, and it's not topical. This happened years ago, but you know, that's the problem with the internet. People recycle the same old shite. What they did recently was someone said, they'd got a shawl that belonged to Mary Kelly, I believe, who was, I believe she was one of the 5th canonical victims. Could be wrong. I haven't got my details in front of me. And they said they got her shawl. There was blood on it. They tested the DNA and it linked to, I believe it was Kosminski, the Polish suspect, which a lot of people say is, or they reckon it's like the number one suspect. Okay, and everyone's excited about it. They're going, we got DNA evidence about Jack the Ripper. Right, here's my take on this, and I've spoken with 2 detective chief inspectors about this. I've also spoken to people who are Ripper specialists on this, and this is the problem with this theory. Okay, one, this shawl that belonged to Mary Kelly, it wasn't put into evidence in 1888, which is the original year. It was put into evidence 10 years later, so there's no evidence that it was her shawl at all. Okay, literally we have a family member saying it was Mary Kelly's shawl and, you know, it's got blood on it. And it's like, is it her shawl? We don't know that. We don't know that at all. Secondly, and this is the most important one, how can you get DNA off a shawl that's 140 years old, which hasn't been put in a protective bag, hasn't been sealed anywhere like modern DNA would be? If you look at any of the murder investigations, if say you're drinking a cup of tea and you hold your cup of tea, you've got your DNA on the cup of tea, right? But if someone else comes along and picks up the cup of tea and drinks from it, their DNA supersedes your DNA, and it's a mixed profile. So you won't get one DNA, you'll get two DNAs. If someone else does that, you get three DNAs. And what you're dealing with here is a shawl, which for more than 140 years has never been in a sealed bag, has never been protected. Basically, every dickhead in the world who has an interest in the case has come along and picked up the shawl and go, "Oh, look, the shawl." So how many people have touched it? Hundreds. How many people's fluid is on it? Probably hundreds. So how can we say that that's Jack the Ripper's DNA? How can we prove that there's one DNA on it? There's not. There'll be hundreds. The police's DNA will be on it. The original pathologist's DNA will be on it. So it's not possible at all. And also, how can you say that's Jack the Ripper's DNA? Not possible at all, unless you believe it was Kosminski, which many people do. But you know what? I've spoken to many Ripper specialists on this, and they say of the canonical five, which people keep believing is true, they keep saying, "Oh, it has to be a canonical five," because people are so desperate to believe that there was those five victims. But people, their evidence changes depending on which suspect they feel is most accurate. Some people believe there's four victims, some people believe there's six, some people believe there's 10 victims. I've spoken to some Ripper specialists, one of whom who actually lectures on Jack the Ripper, and she actually said that with the evidence that there is at the moment, they would say that there's Jack the Ripper was likely to have had two victims or possibly one. So the likelihood of there being a Jack the Ripper at all is just, it's bullshit. But you have to say, as a piece of storytelling, it's amazing because it's lasted 140 years. What other murderer are we still talking about 140 years later? Do you know? So that's my take on it. Obviously, some of you out there may be, "Oh no, Jack the Ripper definitely exists." Fine, if you believe in that, fine, go with it. I think it's complete and utter horseshit. I think it's an absolute fabrication. If you look at all the murders that happened in that era around the same time, they're not unique. There wasn't just five murders that happened and then a man ran away into the shadows going, "Whoa, ha, ha, ha," like that. It's if you look prior to Jack the Ripper and post Jack the Ripper, the murder of prostitutes in the East End of London, there's a lot of it going on. But all these murders that happened after him, not mentioned. No one gives a shit. Everyone, the tabloid press were excited about it because it was a way to draw in working class people into their newspapers. This was the birth of tabloid newspapers. They needed something to draw people in, and the murder of doctors or politicians really wasn't, no one gave a shit anymore. They wanted something that was local to them. Murder of prostitutes was fantastic. The press worked out. It was a great way to make a sensation. The Ripper letters, the Dear Boss letters, even the experts agree at the moment that these were written by the press. These were fabrications to draw people in, right? So Jack the Ripper is a character. He never said, "I am Jack the Ripper." This is just a man who's murdering. He didn't sit down and go, "Do you know what? I'm going to put on a cloak and a top hat and I'm going to run around the streets and I'm going to call myself Jack the Ripper." Murderers don't do that. Murderers murder. That's their priority. That's what they do. But it's highly likely that these weren't the work of a serial killer. If you look at them, they're probably, you know, crimes of passion, robberies that have gone wrong, or just someone with a grudge, you know. They're all very simple murders. There's nothing really exceptional about them, except, you know, the final one that we all know about. But that very much is a crime of passion, that is. So I don't know, if you believe in Jack the Ripper, fine, but I just think there's more important murders out there that we could be investigating. Jack the Ripper just takes up too much time. Ugh. Anyway, second question from Matt. Sorry, that was a long answer. Second question from Matt. Please don't email me with your theories about Jack the Ripper. Please, I'm just not interested. I will delete your email. I swear. I know. I always read everyone's email, but if your email is titled Jack the Ripper or it has Jack the Ripper in it, I'm going to delete it. I really do apologise. Just not interested in Jack the Ripper at all. Although I have to say, that book that's out recently called The Five, what's her name? The historian who did it. She always does a really amazing job. Go and check out The Five. It doesn't do what everyone else does, which is talk about, "Oh, who is Jack the Ripper? Do you know, I want to know who the murderer is." You know, that sensational bullshit that everyone loves. She's done it properly. She sat down and she went, "Don't give a shit who Jack the Ripper is. Who are these women?" And she takes the canonical five and she goes through their history. And it's fascinating. It really is. It really throws into perspective the difference between what the press say the bullshit that's out there already, that people who read these Jack the Ripper books go, oh yeah, the Ripper, oh, I love who the Ripper is. When you read her book, you go, oh my God, these, you know, she brings the women to life. She makes them real. And when you read it, the murder becomes entirely irrelevant because their lives are entirely fascinating. And they're not five prostitutes, as most of these books say. She dives into their history about where they come from, what they're about. It's fascinating. So check it out. It's called The Five. Sorry, Matt, second question. Cool, dear, this is going on a bit, isn't it? Matt's question. Seeing as the scope of your geographic location, that you focus on is a small area. Obviously, Matt doesn't say it this way. Do you ever come across the same individuals over multiple cases? I know that you mentioned the pathologist Spilsbury a few times, but do you ever come across the same witnesses in multiple cases that you are studying? It's interesting. People do crop up every so often. Not really witnesses, but obviously we get the same people, especially with... Oh God, my brain is gone. Brain is totally gone this morning. Cup of tea. With the police especially. So, obviously we've got Frederick Cheryl, who's the fingerprint specialist, who's kind of... he even around the 1940s with the Blackout Ripper, he was doing all of his own fingerprinting. He wouldn't get his team in. He'd literally, if there was a murder scene, he'd come in to make sure he's doing it himself. Obviously, we've got Sir Bernard Spilsbury, the pathologist, the father of forensic science. I'm hoping across... we've already had some Sir Bernard Spilsbury cases. There will be... I think there's another two in this season. And then we will do some more next season. And what my plan is... See, I'm giving away the plan. This is really stupid, but there we go. What the plan is I'm going to do a kind of a story about Sir Bernard Spilsbury, about his life. And what the idea is that you will go, you'll remember all of the other stories and you can re-listen to them if you like. And it's about Spilsbury. It's about his evidence. And I'm not going to say any more than that. We also get in the later series, we get Professor Keith Simpson, who was the pathologist. He was after Spilsbury. My screen went off. And he actually picked up on a lot of the mistakes that Spilsbury did. So he's a fantastic pathologist as well. He worked in the same area. Really good book about him, about his pathology as well. There's a lot of the same detectives as well, especially in the 1970s. I can't remember their names off the top of my head. Other people that we'll see in the same cases, the Messina brothers. I mentioned those in the Ginger Ray episode. They were the pimps who ran Soho in the 1930s, 1940s. They came in at around the same time as Dutch Leia as well. I'm still doing bits and pieces about the Messinas. They may crop up again, I think. I don't know. But in terms of witnesses... Not really at the moment, but it's all interesting, is it? I don't know. Cool. I ran out of steam then. Did you hear me? Anyway, if you have any questions, not about Jack the Ripper, if you have any questions, just whiz them to me. Feel free. Probably best to email me. Some people do message me on Instagram. I still have no idea how to use Instagram properly. Apparently there is an inbox there, but some people have messaged me and I just forget. It's like it's not obvious to me that it's there. So like 3 months later I go, oh look, there's some messages in my Instagram. I don't read the inbox on Instagram at all. If you have any questions, email me. My email address, mmiletours@gmail.com. you can go onto my websites everywhere. Whew, good, that was that. Oh, right, and now I've got to sit down and edit this. I'm gonna whiz through it, edit it, and then go off to the dentist and have my face pulled apart. That'll be fine, it'll all be good. Anyway, that was the episode for today. Hope you liked it. As mentioned, next week's episode is the two-parter that I originally pulled out. This was the two-parter that I was going to open the series with, but they're very different. It's not... So today's episode and last week's episode, the last four episodes you've had, have all been ones about where I've made you sympathise with the character and their plight, and then they get murdered, and then we go into the case, and, you know, hopefully there's some tears in there somewhere. Next week's episode, it's very clear from the start. I make it very clear. I've put a little warning at the start. You won't sympathise with anyone at all. You won't like anyone. All of them are arseholes. Person gets murdered. Meh, who really cares? But that's not what it's about. What it's about is how police are faced with a situation, like a murder investigation, and on the face of it, you look at it and you go, well, this must be easy to solve. There's 40 people in a room that's about as big as someone's living room. One person gets shot 4 times and stabbed. And you go, well, everyone must have seen him. And what I do is I go through it very meticulously. So this is one of those episodes where we're not going to focus on the emotion of it. We're not going to focus on sympathy. Literally, we're going to focus on it and we're going to go through every single bloody detail. And it's hard work, I will say it now. But it's very different to anything I've done before. It's exhausting. And this is also why it's two-parter going out at the same time. Because there's no emotional involvement from you in the story, or from me as well, there's no reason for you to come back next week to see what happened. That's why I'm doing both parts at the same time. So you do one part, there'll be an extra mile at the end. It'll be the original extra miles that I recorded back in April when the episode was ready. I explained that anyway. And then it'll be the second part where we do the unravelling of the investigation and how the police managed to solve it. So it's really interesting, but just get ready. It's very different to anything that we've done before. Whew, right. That was Murder Mile. That was Extra Mile. Hope you enjoyed that. More episodes to come. All good. Planning the season across the year. And then we will have some mini miles as well. So that's good. So hope you enjoyed that. I'm off to edit this. And edit this. This is going to take like 3 days to edit. I'll go to the dentist as well. All joy. So that was good. Hope all is well. And have yourself a good week. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.